Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Kelly Jean Kelly and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Kelly Jean Kelly.
Pope Francis is visiting Thailand to support the country's small Roman Catholic community. His three-day stay will be followed by a similar visit to Japan. The Pope plans to discuss human trafficking, peacemaking, and other subjects. Francis is expected to express love and respect for Thailand's Catholics. Their ancestors brought the religion to the widely Buddhist nation. The Pope was greeted when he arrived Wednesday morning by Thai official Surayat Chuyanon. Surayat heads King Maha Vajiralongkorn's Privy Council and is a former prime minister. The Pope also visited with a small group of children in traditional Thai clothing, and he received a military welcome. While he is in the area, Francis plans to meet with Thai officials, all the Catholic bishops of Asia, and the leader of Buddhism in Thailand. Francis has made the fight against human trafficking a major aim of his leadership. He is expected to raise this issue in Thailand, which is a key place along the path of human trafficking, forced labor, and the sex trade. Francis is marking the 350th anniversary of the creation of official Catholic offices in Thailand, known then as Siam. He is to lead a religious service at the National Stadium. Tens of thousands of Thai Catholics are expected to attend. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Beekeeper Pablo Alvarez sits near his hives and points up into a cloudless blue Chilean sky. Bees come and go along an imaginary line he makes with his finger. They travel as if following an unseen road in the air. This season, Alvarez says, there is much less bee traffic than usual. A quick look around his yard tells the story. Southern Hemisphere spring rains once led to fields of dandelion flowers in Casablanca, a town on the Chilean Pacific coast. Now there is just dry earth. Alvarez is secretary of Casablanca's beekeeper organization. He says he lost half of his hives by early spring. At the end of winter, bees need flowers to grow and make honey, he told Reuters reporters. No flowers means no food, he added. His story is common among beekeepers across much of central Chile. A severe years-long lack of rain is making life difficult for honeybees. Concern over how the changing environment has affected bees has reached the highest levels of government in Chile. The country has already provided large amounts of money for farmers suffering from the drought. In August, it said it would include the costs of climate change in future agency budgets. We all know the importance that bees have in agricultural production. Agriculture Minister Antonio Walker recently told reporters, "Honeybees pollinate many of Chile's major export crops, including avocados, blueberries, raspberries, apples, cherries, and almonds." Last year, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization found that Chile was already well short of the hives it needed to meet the demands of farmers. And honey exports dropped by half last season compared to the year before, trade data show. Daniel Barrera is a bee industry expert with the Agriculture Ministry. He said an exact count of hives lost this year will not be available until 2020. But reports from the field have not been hopeful. "We are not going to wait until we have the final data to take emergency action," he said. Already, agriculture officials have ordered a state of emergency in more than 100 farm communities throughout central Chile. Though dry periods are normal from time to time, officials say climate change has made the current dry period longer and more severe. Rainfall in September in Santiago was down nearly 80% compared to the historical average. Hernan Chavez has long kept bees near the snowy Andes Mountains, outside Santiago. This year, hillsides lacking plants forced him to move his hives to the polluted city center instead, where flowers still grow. "There's always someone watering plants," Chavez said of the city. Chavez normally rents his 800 hives in the spring to pollinate the avocado crop. But last winter, three-quarters of his bees died. "The drought has really hit us hard," he said. Maida Verde is a Cuban animal doctor who works with the research laboratory Fraunhofer Chile. She has advised more than 100 beekeepers in the country on quick fixes to help their bees deal with a changing climate. "There are things, which not everyone is doing, that can reduce the impact," she said. Alvarez of Casablanca agrees. He has begun taking care of an organic bee yard filled with native, drought-resistant plants. Yet even as he describes those efforts, the horn of a water truck sounds. His well has run dry. Now he must pay for water, too. "Even once simple solutions are getting harder," said Enrique Mejias, a Santiago-based scientist. "There's no water anywhere," Mejias said. "The bees are suffering, just the same as cattle, crops, and people."
One argument for why robots will never fully measure up to people is because they lack human-like social skills. But researchers are experimenting with new methods to give robots social skills to better interact with humans. Two new studies provide evidence of progress in this kind of research. One experiment was carried out by researchers from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. The team developed a machine learning system for self-driving vehicles that is designed to learn the social characteristics of other drivers. The researchers studied driving situations to learn how other drivers on the road were likely to behave. Since not all human drivers act the same way, the data was meant to teach the driverless car to avoid dangerous situations. The researchers say the technology uses tools borrowed from the field of social psychology. In this experiment, scientists created a system that attempted to decide whether a person's driving style is more selfish or selfless. In road tests, self-driving vehicles equipped with the system improved their ability to predict what other drivers would do by up to 25%. In one test, the self-driving car was observed making a left-hand turn. The study found the system could cause the vehicle to wait before making the turn if it predicted the oncoming drivers acted selfishly and might be unsafe. But when oncoming vehicles were judged to be selfless, the self-driving car could make the turn without delay because it saw less risk of unsafe behavior. Wilco Swarting is the lead writer of a report describing the research. He told MIT News that any robot working with or operating around humans needs to be able to effectively learn their intentions to better understand their behavior. People's tendencies to be collaborative or competitive often spill over into how they behave as drivers, Swarting said. He added that the MIT experiments sought to understand whether a system could be trained to measure and predict such behaviors. The system was designed to understand the right behaviors to use in different driving situations. For example, even the most selfless driver should know that quick and decisive action is sometimes needed to avoid danger, the researchers noted. The MIT team plans to expand its research model to include other things that a self-driving vehicle might need to deal with. These include predictions about people walking around traffic, as well as bicycles and other things found in driving environments. The researchers say they believe the technology could also be used in vehicles with human drivers. It could act as a warning system against other drivers judged to be behaving aggressively. Another social experiment involved a game competition between humans and a robot. Researchers from Carnegie Mellon University tested whether a robot's trash talk would affect humans playing in a game against the machine. To trash talk is to talk about someone in a negative or insulting way, usually to get them to make a mistake. A humanoid robot named Pepper was programmed to say things to a human opponent, like, "I have to say, you are a terrible player." Another robot statement was, "Over the course of the game, your playing has become confused." The study involved each of the humans playing a game with the robot 35 different times. The game was called Guards and Treasures, which is used to study decision-making. The study found that players criticized by the robot generally performed worse in the games than humans receiving praise. One of the lead researchers was Fei Fang, an assistant professor at Carnegie Mellon's Institute for Software Research. She said in a news release, the study represents a departure from most human-robot experiments. This is one of the first studies of human-robot interaction in an environment where they are not cooperating, Fang said. The research suggests that humanoid robots have the ability to affect people socially just as humans do. Fang said this ability could become more important in the future when machines and humans are expected to interact regularly. We can expect home assistants to be cooperative, she said. But in situations such as online shopping, they may not have the same goals as we do. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. South Carolina withdrew from the United States on December 20th, 1860. The state seceded because a Republican, Abraham Lincoln, had been elected president. The Republicans were a new party, and Lincoln was the first to be elected president. They wanted to stop slavery from spreading into the Western territories. Southern states believed they had a constitutional right to take property, including slaves, anywhere. They also feared that any interference with slavery would end their way of life. Frank Oliver and Larry West tell what happened after South Carolina left the Union.
South Carolina faced several problems after it seceded. The most serious problem was what to do with property owned by the federal government. There were several United States forts in and around the port of Charleston. Fort Moultrie had fewer than 70 soldiers. Castle Pinckney had only one. And Fort Sumter, which was still being built, had none. The commander of the forts asked for more men. Without them, he said, he could not defend the forts. The army refused. It told the commander to defend the forts as best he could. He was told to do nothing that might cause South Carolina to attack. If South Carolina attacked or planned to attack, then he could move his men into the fort that would be easiest to defend. That would probably be the new one, Fort Sumter.
The governor of South Carolina planned to stop any movement of federal troops. He ordered state soldiers to stop every boat in Charleston Harbor. They were to permit no United States troops to reach Fort Sumter. If any boat carrying troops refused to stop, the state soldiers were to sink it and seize the fort. 6 days after South Carolina seceded from the Union, the commander of Charleston's forts decided to move his men to Fort Sumter. They would move as soon as it was dark. The federal troops crossed the port in small boats. The state soldiers did not see them. The governor was furious when he learned what had happened. He demanded that the federal troops leave Fort Sumter. The commander said they would stay. The governor then ordered state soldiers to seize the other two forts in Charleston Harbor. And he ordered the state flag raised over all other federal property in the city.
President James Buchanan, who would leave office in just a few months, was forced to deal with the situation. His cabinet was deeply divided on the issue. The Southerners wanted him to recognize South Carolina and order all federal troops out of Charleston Harbor. The Northerners said he must not give up any federal property or rights. The president agreed to meet with three representatives from South Carolina. They had come to Washington to negotiate the future of federal property in their state. The attorney general said the meeting was a mistake. These gentlemen, he said, claimed to be ambassadors of South Carolina. This is foolish. They cannot be ambassadors. They are lawbreakers, traitors, and should be arrested. You cannot negotiate with them.
The Attorney General and the Secretary of State threatened to resign if President Buchanan gave in to South Carolina's demands. The president finally agreed not to give in. He said he would keep federal troops in Charleston Harbor. And he said Fort Sumter would be defended against all hostile action. On the last day of 1860, he ordered 200 troops and extra supplies sent to Fort Sumter. The War Department wanted to keep the operation secret. So the troops and supplies were put on a fast civilian ship instead of a slower warship. It was thought that a civilian ship could get into Charleston Harbor before state forces could act. But a Southern senator learned of the operation. He warned the governor of South Carolina. When the ship arrived in Charleston Harbor, South Carolina soldiers were waiting.
The soldiers lit a cannon and fired a warning shot. The ship refused to stop. Other cannons then opened fire. The commander of federal troops at Fort Sumter had a difficult decision to make. He had received permission to defend the fort if attacked, but his orders said nothing about defending ships. He knew that if he opened fire, the United States and South Carolina would be at war. The decision was made for him. South Carolina's cannons finally hit the ship. The ship slowed, then turned back to sea. It returned north with all the troops and supplies.
The commander of Fort Sumter sent a message to the governor of South Carolina. "Your forces," he wrote, "fired this morning on a civilian ship flying the flag of my government. Since I have not been informed that South Carolina declared war on the United States, I can only believe that this hostile act was done without your knowledge or permission. For this reason, and only this, I did not fire on your guns." If, the commander said, the governor had approved the shelling, it would be an act of war, and he would be forced to close the port of Charleston. No ship would be permitted to enter or leave. The governor's answer came back within hours. He said South Carolina was now independent. He said the attempt by the United States to strengthen its force at Fort Sumter was clearly an act of aggression, and he demanded that the commander surrender.
During the crisis over Fort Sumter, Congress tried to find a compromise that might prevent war. Lawmakers proposed a new line across the country. South of the line, slavery would be permitted. North of the line, slavery would be illegal. Many Republicans supported the proposal, even though the Republican Party opposed the spread of slavery into the Western territories. One Republican, however, rejected the idea completely. He was Abraham Lincoln, who would take office as president in March. Lincoln said there could be no compromise on extending slavery. "If there is," he said, "then all our hard work is lost. If trouble comes, it is better to let it come now than at some later time."
The trouble would come soon. One by one, the states of the South seceded. By February 1st, 1861, six states had followed South Carolina out of the Union. A few days later, representatives from the states met in Montgomery, Alabama. Their job was to create a new nation. It would be an independent republic called the Confederate States of America. The convention approved a constitution for the new nation. The document was like the Constitution of the United States, but with major changes. The Southern Constitution gave greater importance to the rights of states, and it said there could be no laws against slavery. The convention named former United States Senator Jefferson Davis to be president of the Confederate States of America. Davis did not want civil war, but he was not afraid of it. He said, "Our separation from the old Union is complete. The time for compromise has passed. Should others try to change our decision with force, they will smell Southern gunpowder and feel the steel of Southern swords."
Jefferson Davis left his farm in Mississippi to become president of the Confederate States of America on February 11th. On that same day, Abraham Lincoln left his home in Illinois to become president of the United States. As Lincoln got on the train that would take him to Washington, he said, "I now leave, not knowing when or whether ever I may return. The task before me is greater than that which rested upon our first president. Without the help of God, I cannot succeed. With that assistance, I cannot fail. Let us hope that all yet will be well."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.